Yes.
Under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Having a little trouble hearing myself this morning.
All right. How's that? Is that any better?
It is somewhat better.
I can rarely hear myself when I speak, if I'm speaking in my head. So
I'm going to have to think about that for a while. Anyway, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, which you probably figured out because I just told you. It is also the name of an SEC registered investment advisor in Salado, Texas. And that is no coincidence, because the two guys who give investment advice there give educational advice here. And that's what this is. It's educational. It's not considered to be investment advice. Investment advice is given to people individually, according to their situation. The other thing is we get our information from sources we believe quite sincerely are reliable, things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Barron's, Moody's Analytics, places that have reputations and you have to pay for. And we believe they're correct, but we don't make any warranty as to the correctness of their or accuracy and all that other kind of stuff. And there's something else we're supposed to disclose too, aren't we?
We're registered with the SEC.
I already said that.
But that doesn't mean that they give us any form of approval except
or disapproval.
Right. It's just that that's who we register with. It's kind of like registering to vote. As long as you are allowed to, they let you. Now, there's a lot of hoops to jump through, but there's there's no approval implied from the SEC.
And the telephone number in here, presuming that where you are is March 17th, Saturday, 2018, then we're live as opposed to dead. And,
there's a guy in Turkey trying to prove his living status.
Well, actually, he's in Romania. He used to be in Turkey. He got deported. Anyway, the telephone number to call is 254-773-1400 if you have any thoughts, comments, or anything else about what we're talking about, or something else to do with the economy, investing, or things of that ilk.
So what happened this week?
Well, the S&P 500 declined.
It declined to what? It declined to accompany us to a
party? It dropped down to 2752. You probably don't track the numbers. But that's about 1.25% drop this week, 1.5% drop on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And it's still, we hit a high at the end of January, around January 26th, and it is still well below that high. It is up for the year a little bit. It is certainly up quite a lot for the
12-month period.
For the 12-month period, you know, the S&P 500 is up 15.72%. Although that will come to an end if it keeps on wobbling around. And, you know, one of the big issues is, well, of course, let me back up. Let me say that at the same time, the interest rates on the 10-year Treasury note declined from about 2.9 to about 2.85, which doesn't sound like very much.
That's 0.05%.
But it declined, and it declined in an economy where our manufacturing output was up. Everything in the economy, if we look at what's going on over the last year, would indicate that we have a really healthy, strong growth going on, and we have a lot of momentum. We just hit a record, at least for the last 7 years, on business investment in the fourth quarter.
Right.
It takes a while for that all to be compiled, so we're just now getting fourth quarter business investment. Business investment meaning reinvestment or investment of money from businesses in long-term major capital items like equipment and real estate and improvements in the real estate and whatever, with the intent of making money and doing big things in the future, which is a good thing, but that was in the fourth quarter. The market has been in wobble mode now through most of February and into March. It's in what's called a correction phase.
I think we should coin that term.
The
wobble mode.
It's a waffle mode, actually, I think, you know.
I think wobble's better because other people might say waffle.
Well,
so the market's been wobbly.
It's been wobbly, and it's wobbly for a pretty good reason. And the same reason that, by the way, that at least according to the commentary in Barron's, which I thought was very, very insightful, for the same reason the dollar is down 8% over the last year.
Because we have just begun the process that could lead to a major trade war.
Yeah, and it really boils down to the fact that markets hate uncertainty. And we got a lot of uncertainty. We had, for the last year, up until the end of January, we had some pretty good certainty. And we had some pretty good comforting. The things are being done that will cause that will not at least get in the way of the economy roaring ahead and continuing to accelerate. There are no big negatives were coming out anywhere. We were on track to do quite well. And then, as much as has been talked about the sudden announcement that the trade tariffs were going to go up and very high trade tariffs really have had an impact on people's judgment as to whether the market will be higher a year from now or lower a year from now, which is what causes people to buy and sell in the stock market. And you can actually kind of watch the war go on back and forth. And the more uncertainty there is, the more it dips. And then we get some positive economic news and it comes up. And then we get something comes out of the White House and it goes back down again. And we're in a what they call a crux. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
A cross is what that means.
Right.
If the verbal and other things coming out of the White House continue as they are, there's a lot of concern that this bull market could be over. And I don't mean...
And it would be a premature over.
Yeah,
because there's still good earnings coming out. Don't get us wrong here. There are parts of the stock market that we can very easily identify that are way overpriced. The majority of the stock market, I would say, is fairly or underpriced still. And when looking at it from that perspective, there's no reason for the bull market to be over at this point, except if we start putting restrictions on our ability to sell things to people and buy things from people.
The Atlanta Fed has a report they call GDP Now, in which they estimate the current quarter's gross domestic product on an annualized basis, and they've dropped it now below 2%.
And they started
like 2.5, I think.
Well, somewhere right around the end of January, they had a spike in there in their expectations that was almost at 5.5%.
So,
because it's based on the new tax law, and they thought if all things go according to plan, all of the companies bring money back from overseas, all of the companies here boost their capital expenditures and their self-investment, then we're going to have this big boost to the GDP. And that was the Atlanta Fed. And by the way, just kind of as a side note, the Atlanta Fed is known to be the most conservatively aligned just because that district is a very conservative district, not because there are political connotations to the heads of the banks there. But they tend to believe conservative rhetoric more.
That's because they talk like this, and that's it. That in Atlanta, and that means that they can't think too far forward because they.
No. Let's not be rude.
Well, we have relatives in Atlanta, and in the Atlanta area, and they do talk that way.
Yeah, and they do think ahead. They just tend to be more aligned with the political. Judgments of the conservative side. Now, the Dallas Fed is very economics oriented. They don't have these, we were just talking about the GDP now at the Atlanta Fed. They don't have big spikes and drops and things like that in their expectations for GDP. They're much more, and this is funny because they're much more conservative in their predictions. While a conservative district is a lot more liberal in their predictions as long as it's in line with a conservative agenda, which is one of those weird twisty pretzel mind puzzles. But, it's very much like gun companies filing for bankruptcy while there's a Republican in the White House but making record profits when there's a Democrat in the White House.
There's an aspect to what's going on right now that's like the way the market is wobbling is contradictory, and it's kind of fascinating. There's a lot of worries coming up, new worries, and a lot of reasons that this bull market could be over. And there's a lot of things that indicate that the possibility exists that enough economic damage would be done by executive decisions to really screw things up.
Right.
But a bull market climbs a wall of worry.
Which is excellent because everybody's worried right now. This actually means that we may be extending. This is where we come out from the external analysis, and we're looking at it from the McClure perspective. We just had a huge amount of worry put back into the market, which should cause some more wobbly. And when we were saying back in January, and this is, we've gotten, I don't know how many people have congratulated you, but I've had a lot of people congratulate me for something that I wasn't even aware that we had done.
What did we do?
Evidently, we called the correction. And to me, that means we said there's a correction coming this date, time.
Oh, yeah. We put it in the newsletter.
We put it in the newsletter. We said it was coming. We said, but we didn't say it was coming this month or this week. The fact that we wrote about it the week that it happened is really nice. But I'm saying that to say we wanted the correction to happen.
And it's still happening.
Which is one of those things that people go, what? You wanted the market to drop? Yes. When we're looking at fund flow data of people putting money into the market and who is putting money into the market and where it's going in the market, what became apparent in January is a lot more amateurs were jumping into the market. That's really bad for bull markets.
Who promptly jumped out again with less money.
Yes. They left the market almost as soon as they jumped into the market because it dropped. And that's part of the reason why it dropped is because they left the market because it was dropping. So what we're doing is making sure with these downturns, we're making sure that the people that are in are really in. They're not someone that's really ready to step out as soon as there's a little bit of trouble. So we're still in the process of doing that. And as long as there's enough worry, then it's only the serious money that's getting invested. This is something it's a lot easier to look at when you see something as simple like Bitcoin. Not that most people would call Bitcoin simple. It's just one commodity, though. So we can look at it as a one thing, Bitcoin. As long as the people that were putting money into Bitcoin were, I like to call them true believers, they wanted to use it as a currency. They wanted to remove the governmental control of the monetary marketplace. They wanted to have independence and be able to do things without Big Brother looking over their shoulders. And some of that was crime related, but it wasn't even the majority of it. These true believers are still there. But so many amateurs got involved and started blowing up the price of these cryptocurrencies that no more new true believers were being made. Because when you talk about Bitcoin, you're not talking to a true believer anymore. You're not talking about to someone that's passionate about separating currency and governments. Now you're talking to people that are interested in buying a Ferrari. And when they are driving Italian car, you would think it starts with an F, but no, it's a Fiat, because the Ferrari and Fiat is the Bitcoin marketplace right now. You either have a Ferrari or a Fiat, and if you have a Fiat, you want the Ferrari, and right now, if you have a Ferrari, you're thinking about selling it because your Bitcoins are not worth as much as they used to be. So as that concept comes forward, amateurs in a marketplace distort the marketplace, whether that's real estate or Bitcoin or the stock market. In the real estate market, when you have a bunch of people that have no idea anything about real estate, this is a direct look back at the 2005 through 2007 era, these people jumping into the real estate market to make a bunch of money, but they don't know anything about real estate. They have at times in their lives changed light bulbs, but they're now trying to get more value out of their house by painting a room or changing a sink and expecting that to be tens of thousands of dollars more. That's when the amateurs take over. And it's a really good indicator of a bubble. Well, we started to see amateurs coming into the market in large numbers in January, and they have been shaken out. We're pretty happy about that.
Well, if I could change the subject.
You could.
There was – last week we talked about this, and it has been a major conundrum for economists. Where did the 800,000 people that entered the job market come from in the last report? In February, there were about – well, actually, in 1 week, there were like 800,000 people joined the job force that were not previously listed as unemployed and were immediately hired. Like 795,000 of them were immediately hired. So the unemployment rate stayed the same. The number of people unemployed pretty much stayed the same. Everything stayed the same except for the fact that we suddenly had 800,000 more people working in the United States than were working before. And I read today, have you read where this they have been identified?
Who is it? Who is it?
Puerto Ricans.
That's fascinating.
And you have to dig through the numbers to find this. About 16.4% of the working population in the United States is Hispanic. However, during this week where you suddenly have this surge of new entries into the job market that are immediately hired, about 60% of that surge have Hispanic surnames. So when you got 16% of the people in the United States who are Hispanic and you get a 60% surge in job applicants who get hired immediately, you got to say, okay, let's take a look at that. And it turns out that if you dig a little deeper, you find out that those particular Hispanic surnames are almost universally of Puerto Rican origin. And what happened is, for those of you who have forgotten about this, we had a couple of hurricanes hit Puerto Rico and pretty much wiped the island out. There's still places on the island, large swaths of the island, where there's no electrical power.
Right. No roofs, no plumbing.
The people who have any skills at all are fleeing the island as fast as they can. And apparently, towards the beginning of this year, about over a million four, something like that, people left the island and came to the United States. And I don't think they came all on the same day or anything
no,
like that.
No, it was just, not on the
is,
same
this
airplane.
This is what it picked up on the. This is what picked up in the census data. Well, you know, this includes wives and children and lots of things, and they're scattering across the United States. So it's kind of hard to nail them down. But that's where
I don't think it's appropriate to nail down wives and children. It sounds inappropriate.
Statistics. We're nailing down statistics.
Statistics. All right. Statistics can be nailed down. That's a much nicer terminology.
So the bottom line to it is there's a pretty strong argument can be made that the labor pool is not as deep as that would indicate. There was this thought that wow, there's maybe a lot of people out there because of the improved job conditions or something changed and they suddenly went to work. Well, if you look at what changed, nothing changed. The wages didn't go up. The benefits didn't go up. But we had a lot of job openings. We still do, by the way. Had a lot of job openings in the United States that we couldn't find anybody to fill. And all of a sudden, whoom, bang, 800,000 people showed up and filled 800,000 of them.
We now have more job openings than unemployed people.
Yes.
This is kind of a first. I mean, that is a secondary definition of full employment.
And in the process, we've pretty much stripped most of the skilled labor out of Puerto Rico.
Yes, which is not a good sign for the Puerto Rican bond market, even though right now there's some surprises about how well they're paying. Just be aware that it may not continue. Their tax revenue is about to drop drastically.
In the larger economy, this has some what the British refer to as knock-on side effects.
Yeah.
We call them side effects. They call them knock-ons.
Because why not?
Why not? Right. They use knock up a lot, too, for reasons completely different from the ones we do. But the reason I say that is because traditional economics looks at the job situation in the United States right now and says we're at pretty nearly full employment. We can hire a few more people without really messing things up, but we are hiring people a lot faster. Like we've 300,000 new hires officially. In the last report that came out, when we only are producing around 100,000 plus or minus a few each week of new people to join, come out of school or wherever, but we're hiring about 300,000. That means we are going to eventually run out of people to hire, and it may be getting very, very close. At that point, companies start bidding up new workers.
We're already seeing the beginnings of that, more than the beginnings. We've begun to see the wages rise. Mm-hmm. They're not rising drastically, but it kind of slows down the wage growth if you have suddenly about 800,000 people appear out of nowhere.
We have about a 2.9% wage increase. It dropped back to 2.6 on this report where all these people came in because an awful lot of people from Puerto Rico basically took lower wages. The reason this is important is because one of the great fears in the market and the economy right now is that the Federal Reserve will see inflation suddenly rear its ugly head and start raising interest rates faster than was anticipated. Right now, through the arcane method of looking at what people are paying for Treasury inflation-adjusted bonds, notes, bills, and so on, the market is effectively giving an 18% probability that the Fed will raise rates 0.5% at the next meeting rather than 0.25%. Now, that's 100% versus 96% probability at this point that we'll see 0.25% raise at the Fed's next meeting and then at least two more raises during the year. So we'll wind up with 0.75% raises. Interest rates, short-term interest rates will be 0.75% higher.
So the thought is somewhere between 0.75% and 1% higher for short-term stuff.
Yeah, but there is the possibility that if this surge masks the fact that we're now effectively out of workers and wages start up dramatically. Despite the fact that the Secretary of the Treasury did make a statement last week that wages can go up without inflation rising. I don't know where he got that.
It can short term.
Well, he's
very short term.
Talking about
do it
generally that it can happen. When I was asked about that, but he also said about a month before that he had no objection to a weak dollar and then turned around a week later and said he wanted a strong dollar and was opposed to a weak dollar. And by the way, that's one of the reasons the dollar has fallen about 8% in the last year, at least according to the opinion that I've been reading in Barron's, in the Wall Street Journal, and in places where I would, and in Moody's. Is the primary reason the dollar has declined and continues to decline slowly.
Besides the trade issues.
There's several reasons, but this is what's weird. The trade issues normally would be expected to raise the price of the dollar. I know that sounds goofy historically.
No, it makes sense. That's correct.
But the point is that the inconsistency, the dollar, one of the reasons the dollar has been strong for a long time is it is considered to be a safe harbor. It's considered to be safe and secure and consistent. And when the Secretary of the Treasury, who's the guardian, the trustee of the dollar,
one of them, besides but the Federal Reserve,
his signature is on right. the darn thing.
Yeah.
Although he printed his signature this time for some reason.
That's how he signs his name.
Yeah, but I don't know. I would take a check with a printed name on it. Anyway.
That's how he signs his name.
His flip-flopping, or should I say wobbling.
It's a wobble's the good term. We'll use it all through the episode.
His wobbling and the peculiarity of administration policies is sort of depressing on the value of the dollar. Now, I'm in a monologue here, so I'll let you get in. I've got more to say, obviously.
So the weak dollar, long-term, is really good for our trade. It means that we buy things cheaper. This is part of the reason why it's very confusing to be happening when tariffs are coming up here.
Weak dollar means it's
more
expensive.
We sell things cheaper. I'm sorry. Yes, we're selling things cheaper. That's not normal when you put tariffs on things and you expect to have tariffs going the other direction. Usually you get a insular – think of Switzerland. They're not doing a huge amount of outgoing trade. They're just internally very conscious of their mark. And in the process, they cause their currency to be very valuable because they've become very centralized.
Is it a franc?
It's a franc. I'm sorry.
You have to be very frank about that.
Old, archaic forms of currency.
Don't mark it to the franc. Don't franc it to the mark. Anyway, a franking and a marking, by the way, both mean the same thing.
Yes.
There's an interesting aspect also that's causing some concern among economists and investors. And it's a macro issue that I think a lot of people are not aware of, so we'll just talk about it a little bit if you don't mind.
Yeah.
The stated purpose of the tariffs is to reduce the imbalance of trade. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by lowering taxes and raising the deficit dramatically, which, by the way, the Congressional Budget Office and Moody's are both saying that we will hit probably $1 trillion deficit this year.
And it may be more.
Twice, and maybe $1.3 trillion, which is twice what it was last year or the year before. In other words, we basically doubled the annual deficit. The point is, by doubling the deficit, by throwing another $500 billion into the deficit pot, that counts as an import.
Yeah.
I know that sounds really crazy, but if you're borrowing money from overseas to run the government, that means that $500 billion is now going to come in. That you imported $500 billion.
Yeah, it's not really borrowing from overseas, but that's kind of how the math works.
Yeah. So it, depending on what percentage of it, because we're starting to run low on Americans who want to buy treasuries for some reason. And as a result, this last couple of treasury auctions, we had a greater – we normally have like as many as $12 bid for every dollar we want to borrow. And there weren't more bid. It's just that we borrowed a lot more of them. We went up to about a 50 or 60% of everything that was willing to be loaned to us. And we borrowed on it in this last couple of auctions, which is unusually high. And every time we do that, we're effectively increasing the deficit. And there's little odds and ends here. So what you've got is a stimulative effect, which is borrowing a lot more money and lowering taxes, which tends to kick the economy forward. Then tariffs, which tend to slow the economy down and take money back out of the economy and put it in the government's pockets or somebody's pockets. And then you've got the fact that the tariffs were there to try to reduce imports, but the fact that we lowered taxes and increased spending so much increases imports. Now I think you can understand why wobbling, from an economics point of view and from an investing point of view, the dollar and the dollar has been declining and the stock market has been wobbling because, very frankly, there doesn't seem to be any consistency in the economic policy of the United States right now. We have the tremendous advantage of having an economy that has a lot of momentum, is on a roll, is hiring more people than we can produce, but the inconsistency of the way we're like a car with a lot of, or a truck with a lot of mass going down the highway. It's going pretty fast. It's just kind of weaving in its lane at this point, which makes people a little nervous for some reason.
Right. Totally on board with that.
It's just cool.
A lot of uncertainty out there, and it's the uncertainty is coming from people who we are usually certain about saying things that contradict themselves a lot.
Traditionally, presidents have been very, very reluctant to say much of anything that has a great deal of meaning unless they really want to change things, because it produces uncertainty when they, if they're wrong, if they haven't, if something, so they're very cautious in what they say. And we have a president right now who tweets.
And not just tweets. This is
but
something.
But he also makes some interesting speeches.
Right, not just make speeches. This is one of those areas I wanted to talk about it. We've got a lot to talk about today.
Probably need to do commercials.
Let me hit this okay. real quick. It won't take very long. We do not have a trade deficit with Canada.
Yeah, I started to say we have a trade surplus with Canada, but we're slapping tariffs on them.
And when the president, who in a speech later said he didn't know, but I said it anyway because we have deficits with so many, and why do we have deficits? Because we're so stupid.
He admitted that he made up the statement that we have a big deficit with Canada in argument with
right.
the
and
Prime Minister
of
Canada.
There's multiple ways of measuring that, and all of the multiple ways come out to say that Canada is not getting the best end of the bargain with us in almost any direction. It's really, really hard for us to look at it and say that Canada is the greatest benefactor in trade with the United States. We're getting to use their innovations as well as our own. If you throw in the service sector to our deficit surplus kind of calculation, suddenly we are so far into the surplus that it is
Canada should be putting up tariffs against us.
Right. If you think about service, what is Microsoft? What is Apple? What is all of the things that people pay monthly for? And so many different areas is not part of the traditional trade imbalance. Even with that stuff still out of it, just using the traditional trade imbalance, we still have a surplus with them. And that's part of the wobble. The president is usually someone who's very, very sure of what they're saying, not someone that's making stuff up as they go along and then threatening action over ignorance.
And we're not making this up. This is the president did admit publicly that he didn't know that we had a
not only didn't know it
he just made up that we have a deficit with Canada when he made his announcement that we have a big deficit with Canada.
And then when he was informed that we didn't by a staff member, still turned to Trudeau and said, yes, we have a deficit. That's number one, didn't know and said it anyway. Number two, knew and then still said it. There's so much wrong with that. You cannot, this is, you know, relationship 101. If you're lying to your partner, no matter who the partner is, but specifically close partners, and you make something up and you get called on it, you should admit it. You should say, yeah, that's it. You don't double down on it. It doesn't,
well,
trust disappears.
You did this. This particular president is in the habit of negotiating that way.
Right. And the,
doubling
the,
down on
the problem with negotiation with our best friend, though, and Canada is
arguably,
I mean, it's either Canada or Great Britain. I mean, UK or Canada, and Canada has participated in more wars on our side than any other country. If we're treating them like an adversary in a negotiation, that leads to divorce, and that's something this president's got some experience with. So it's something I have a lot of difficulty with lying in general, but to lie, be caught on the lie, and then double down on the lie in a in a situation, I mean, if this is with a negotiation over sanctions with North Korea or Iran, or talking about whether Ukraine should be given back, and they're using like the thumbscrew tactics of let's get some untruth in there, I still have uncomfortable feelings about that, because that's the Russian propaganda concept of we'll just throw out some fake news. If this president is upset about fake news, then he shouldn't be saying fake things. So it sounds very political. We've got to play some commercials. It's right at the time that we would normally play. We've got a lot of other stuff to talk about.
It's been a good week for stuff.
Yeah, that thing really got under my skin. I've got a great deal of respect for the president and for the office of the president. But don't lie. Don't lie, particularly when you're going to get caught.
Well, not only that, but he admitted that he lied. And I'm no.
Yeah, I bragged about it. That's the hard part for me.
I don't understand that, but that's all right. He's who he is.
All right. We've got some commercials to play. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join us in our conversation, you can call 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400, presuming that today is Saturday, March 17th, where you are, and that you have the capability of making sounds on the telephone. I mean, if you were on the moon and you tried to pick up a telephone and talk into it, it wouldn't work real well because, you know, like there's no air.
Cell phone towers are a little lacking up there as well.
Yeah, but didn't you just think you got the high ground? I mean, you can see the cell phone towers on half the planet.
Yeah, you would think that'd be plenty.
Of course, you're a little far away, so the signal might be a little weak.
It might have to be amplified a little.
So give us a call if you have anything to say about anything we said so far this hour, or anything to do with other stuff.
I've got one thing to throw in here. The Senate passed a bill.
Yes.
And that's the entire news.
Okay, thank you very much.
On to the next. It is rewriting a portion of Dodd-Frank. That's not the important part. The important part is the bipartisan nature of this. Dodd-Frank was not bipartisan. Obamacare was not bipartisan. The attempts to repeal Obamacare were not bipartisan. The tax cut was not bipartisan. I was thinking at some point we would come to the end of any ability for Democrats and Republicans to do anything but claw at each other's eyes. They rewrote this portion of Dodd-Frank because it needed to be rewritten. Now, the House is looking at it very differently, and they're throwing the whole bipartisan concept out the window again. But the Senate was able to, with a 67-vote majority, pass a rewrite of Dodd-Frank. It did some things that are, you know, on the surface, they don't seem like that big a deal, though Elizabeth Warren is having her extreme upset over this. She believes that it's just helping the Wall Street banks and so on. But the whole idea here, number one change, was absolutely not Wall Street. It was Dodd-Frank put some extremely strict regulations on a whole group of banks, many of whom didn't have anything to do with the difficulties that led to the collapse, for stress testing and for reserve requirements and how they needed to be held and how they needed to be charged and how much time needed to be spent on stress testing versus running the business. And one of the big changes here was changing the definition of the size of a regional bank. They went from $50 billion to $250 billion. Because
In this most recent thing.
Because it used to be if you're $50 billion or bigger, then you fell under this regulation. To a lot of people, that sounds like a huge amount of money.
It's peanuts.
It's really, in the banking world, not that big. Those are called regional banks, which is almost by definition not Wall Street. Unless it happens to be a New York regional bank.
Well, a New York regional bank almost by definition is outside of New York City.
So. Right. So this concept of regional banks having to perform at the same standards as these very, very large banks to make sure that they were handling it handling their resources well, and to make sure that in a stressful environment in the economy that they could survive. It was effective, but it was also lowering the ability for people to get loans way beyond what it should have. So one of the things that government's really good at is putting in regulations. What they're really bad at is giving us a method of meeting the regulations. That's up to the business. You know, here's the rules, you follow them, is how they go. Even though the government's the one that sets up the tests, they don't give any guidelines on how to prepare for the tests. So it's difficult on a lot of banks. The big banks, they can afford the people just a full time. All they do is prepare for stress tests. At the regional banks, that takes up resources that would normally go to a smaller banking group. And what's happened is that the smaller banks have failed since the recovery at a much higher rate than they did during the recovery. Well, the big banks have been fine. So keep that in mind. This was an onerous task. Both Republicans and Democrats could recognize that this was a problem. There's another area in that
some – it was particularly onerous in that Republicans and Democrats actually cooperated.
Right. Which, this is crazy to think of that.
Which should be a monument put up someplace in D.C. for that.
Another thing is that they were putting the same requirements on banks that had no intent of investing their assets. All they were doing was holding the assets as custodians, as putting them in a safe position with the Federal Reserve, but they were being required to leap through the same hoops as these banks that all they do with their assets is invest in more risky situations. So they said, hey, if you're only custodying the assets, you're not reinvesting it in lots of different areas, you've got an easier set of rules to follow. Now, you've got to meet the requirements of only custodying the assets, but you've got these easier rules, which was effective in State Street and Pershing. And there's an arm of J.P. Morgan Chase that may qualify. There's one other bank that may qualify. But the idea is these are not risky banks. If they start doing risky things, then they should be regulated as a risky bank. But if they're not risky, they shouldn't be put in the same bucket. So they're strangely, this is why the news is important. This was logical, which is kind of an oxymoron when you're talking about Congress. We lowered regulations. It didn't come from the Trump administration. It came from a bipartisan Senate group. What just happened?
Well, let's see if it gets through the House.
Right, that's the big question. But the fact that they can still talk like that in the Senate.
Bipartisan is a four-letter word in the House.
Yes, in the House and in some areas of the Senate. Right. Elizabeth Warren said that this was a kickback to Wall Street, and she's used some other words that are about that inflammatory. And when I look at it, I don't understand her mentality there.
I could just say in general, seems when very it comes politic. To Elizabeth Warren, I don't understand her mentality. I'm not sure she has mentality.
She reacts to the other party and says what they do is wrong.
Right.
That's the thing that I'm applauding right here not happening. If we cannot speak together as Americans, then we've got a very dire future. Yep. If we can figure out how to come together and fix our problems, then we've got a very great future. And this polarization issue is, from my perspective, from the perspective of the market, one of the most dangerous things that we can be doing.
Elizabeth Warren is somewhat of a rock thrower.
Yes. That's how she got where she was.
Absolutely. Hey, there's a lot of things going on out there, but one of the things that we were expecting at this point, let's look at our time here, 10:53.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, we're good.
We were expecting at this point not to see a massive deficit rear up, but we are seeing a massive deficit rear up. The government borrowing is, as we mentioned earlier, accelerating. We had a significant 9% drop in revenue for the month of February for the United States government. That, very frankly, was not expected. And the reason it wasn't expected is January-February timeframe is when the money should be coming in to pay for the overseas investments, the dollars that corporations have overseas that they're going to bring home. They're supposed to pay a 15% tax on liquid assets, 15.5% tax on liquid assets, and 8% on non-liquid assets. And the theory was then they could bring them home for free and they would automatically bring them home. Well, there's some of that going on. I mean, Apple is bringing home $20 billion. But when you look at their total holdings overseas, it's just not very much. And it turned out that in the, I don't remember what it was called, the Jobs Making Tax Cut Trump Act of 2018 or 17 or whatever it was, the tax cut.
Yeah.
There was a provision in there that says if the overseas money held by a United States corporation is invested in illiquid assets, let's say real estates and factories and things like that, then they do not have to pay 15.5% or effectively 16%. They only have to pay 8%.
It was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
I knew it had something jobs and tax cuts. Okay, right. The Tax, Jobs, and Cuts Act.
Yes, that works as
okay.
Well.
Okay, the jobs cut and – never mind. I'm being sarcastic here and I shouldn't. The point is that because the bill was rushed through and people didn't take the time to run it through a bunch of outside observers and say what will be the unexpected side effects of this, it's real simple. The bill was signed, and it's the actual drop dead date when you have to determine where your money is located. The bill was actually signed in 2017, which was really awkward for everybody. But the president had promised that he would do the tax cut before the end of the year, so he signed it in 2017, which affected the fourth quarter earnings of a lot of corporations because they now had a tax bill. But meanwhile, it gave them a window of opportunity, and during that window, apparently they took a lot of their overseas cash and bought something illiquid with it overseas, and it ain't coming home because if they left it in cash and brought it home, they would pay 16% tax, but if they invested in something overseas, their tax bill gets cut in half, and since the dollar is sliding down, they effectively in the last year made another 8% on it, so their tax bill got cut in half, and as the dollar declines, they are making more money on it. And the other thing is, if in fact all those trillions of dollars that were held overseas by corporations were flooding home, like the theory was behind the tax bill, the dollar would not be falling. It would be rising because they would have to convert it from euros or yen or mm-hmm. whatever they had into dollars. That means they'd be buying dollars. And you have a few trillion dollars
that
flow back in the United States, then the dollar would go up, but the dollar hasn't gone up. It's gone down. And it turns out that it would be really, really, really bad stewardship by the board of directors to leave that money in cash and thereby double their
taxes.
Tax bill.
Yeah.
When they could invest it in places in the world that have a lot more room to grow than in the United States right now and cut their tax bill in half. So they did. And that's just one of those reasons. That is a very good reason, whether it be Obamacare or the tax cut bill. Very good reason not to rush a bill through without taking the time to vet it through every kind of experts on both sides of the aisle, get bipartisan agreement on it. The 1986 Tax Act, which was the one, the tax
the,
act
the Reagan
before,
tax
before
cut.
This one. It really mm-hmm. wasn't. The 82 tax was a tax
right.
cut.
It was a flat, three-tier flat
yeah, but
tax.
It was neutral.
Right.
But still, it was a massive overhaul of the tax code, just like
simplification.
This one
massive simplification. This one's massive complification.
But it is still an overhaul of the basic tax code.
By the way, and complification is a new word that we're going to use a lot.
But it took Reagan and Congress 2 years of negotiating and changing things around and posting it again and letting everybody look at it in the clear, broad daylight and say, whoa, if you do this, that will happen. If you do that, this will happen. Still, when the Tax Reform Act of 1986 was passed, even then, after 2 years of consideration, it had some major unexpected effect. It blew the savings and loan industry out of the water, created the savings and loan crisis, and created this minor thing that happened in October of 1987, or at least had something to do with it. But in this particular case, it's just raised the deficits a whole lot.
And we're out of time. If you'd like to call us off the air, 254-947-1111 or 800-914-PLAN.